With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hello, it's the weekend and it's John Givens as we come closer to the return of Premier League football. And to talk about that and lots more besides, I'm joined by Cathy Long, by Siobhan Began, by Ian Ryan and by Andy Heaton. And Andy, I'll start with you. It is getting nearer and nearer. This time next week, we'll have watched some Premier League games on the telly and we'll be waiting for the weekend where everyone's playing and it's all on our screens.
Exciting, isn't it? I'm just looking forward to Arsenal knocking the stuff out of City so we can go...
Hey, lad, they got beat by Brentford yesterday, so I'd control your excitement there.
Listen, I tell you what, City being beaten by a couple of tough teams as well before, you know what I mean? Anything is possible. Anything is possible. I've seen Rob Gutman saying, oh, there's only an 8% chance. I'm taking that 8% to roll it. No, it's exciting, isn't it? Because you forget it's been away for so long and now the wheels are turning, this game's being... play behind closed doors and logistics and all that are being agreed are made up over the moon.
Matty, the Premier League are meeting again today. They seem to meet every Thursday. Maybe they coincide with our weekend sessions. I'm not too sure. But they are, there's a few conversations going on today, some of which I believe is around the Black Lives Matter stuff and the sort of, you know, correct way, if that is the right way to sort of to approach that. I would imagine anything that sort of will be player-led, but these guys are in a boardroom, so they're going to chat about it. What also seems to have been agreed already this morning is this idea of match day protocols, which is all around how the travel work and match day arrangements and ice baths was on the list as well. Very important. Can't forget the ice baths. It just feels like they're ticking the last few boxes here. And, you know, as you expect everything to, you know, to go kind of fairly smoothly now in terms of the organisation. But it's good to know that they're at these stages where everyone's in agreement, apparently unanimous decisions all the way. And yeah, any sort of, you know, disagreements all seem to be a thing of the past now. And we're all singing from the right hymn sheet or whatever metaphor you want to use.
Yeah, no, I think it's been good actually, because like the amount of detail that's come out about it has been good, and I think they've been reasonably transparent in the way that they've gone about it and like telling us all what's been going on, even down to the detail of the ice baths and everything, so people can get a sense of like, well, yeah, they are actually looking into every detail and see what goes on, because generally I don't think there's enough really, you know, out there about exactly what's going on behind the scenes. I mean, you know, I was getting frustrated, obviously, like a lot of people were with the talk and neutral venues and all of that. And all of the time thinking, well, I don't think that's going to happen because, you know, I know what it's like and there's going to be all of these things on the table. Loads of things have to be discussed. You know, Mark Roberts is going to have his say, all the rest of it. And then you're going to get to the point where everyone's just going to actually hopefully make the sensible decisions, which they seem to have made. So, like, that's a big relief. Although, you know, it's... when we playing football seems such a long time ago. Like, I'd forgotten until yesterday that, like, the Blues were talking about, like, boycotting it. Goodison. But that's just really funny now that they were talking talking about boycotting it and not turning up. Now they've all got the perfect excuse because they're not allowed in.
Yeah, they were all flogging the tickets to Norwegians, Ian. So I was about that, paying for summer holidays they were. Just like the Liverpool fans who were moaning that this season was a bit too boring. Be careful what you wish for.
And that's another thing for them to hate us for as well. Tenerife, off the chart. Carpites.
Absolutely. I think I had to laugh before when, in terms of the football coming back, there was a little tweet there that said BBC One are showing the game off the bargain hunt, and it reeled a few in, like, which is clearly not the case, but I liked it anyway. No, I mean, I think it's going to be great to have it back, but I think, you know, we've waited an awful long time for this, haven't we? At times it felt like it might not come back, and you were starting to get concerned. I think I always felt that a null and void thing wouldn't happen, but, you know, when you start to talk about, you know, points per game, you've seen what's happened in League One and League Two, it's no real way to end the football season. I think the most important thing here was, you know, aside from the health stuff, was that we had a chance to finish this on the pitch. Liverpool got a chance to win it on the pitch, which is the right way to do it. I think, you know, the majority of clubs, maybe not the fans, but certainly the majority of clubs would have wanted to get back and start playing football again. It's getting really close now. You can start to, you know, get little clips from the sessions and stuff. You know, lots of people have talked about the Liverpool kind of 11v11 stuff, which looked really good. I'm sure there'll be footage somewhere from the Blackburn game and stuff on it. It's just great to start thinking about getting back again and seeing some of these lads play. You know, you forget just what an unbelievable season they've had up until this point, and yet the best is probably still to come.
Yeah, I mean, forget about these little sessions, Siobhan. Liverpool are playing today against Blackburn Rovers. I don't know where. I don't know when. It's like Vera Lynn, but, you know, but we know that they met again some sunny-ish day somewhere. I mean, they're probably right to say it wasn't at Blackburn, because I'd have been so tempted to get into the furnace with cans and in the car park. So maybe that's why they've kept it from us. But it is another nice little thing, you know, in this return to think that, you know, at some point, presumably, we are going to see a little bit of footage of Mo Salah dancing around some Blackburn defenders, of Jordan Henderson taking umbrage at something and shouting at something, and Virgil, like Van Dijk, sorry, just looking dead cool.
I'm very much enjoying the any stream shouts on Twitter already for the Blackburn game. No one knows where someone's just going around with a little camera on the shoulders like that. Yeah, it's boss, isn't it? Like, you've been seeing little bits of here and there about other teams' training sessions and friendlies and whatever, and you're going, ah, who cares about that? But now it's us, you're like, oh my god, they're playing Blackburn, what's gonna happen? Let's see, I want to see it. Blackburn in some field somewhere, probably on the Dovedale school field behind my house, because it's private.
Well, if you can, you know, get out there with the camera. Yeah, you could be any streams, Siobhan.
I could be ITK.
Yeah, we are going to see. I gather match reports are going to be available, which is good to know. And I presume that at some point we will see a little bit, and that is kind of something to be excited about. Andy, there's also a few things today about sort of future stuff. According to a BBC report, the sport, alongside a few others, are already in discussions with the government experts on sort of when fans might return. There's no timescales on that yet, but it just shows how things are moving along, that even those conversations are sort of taking place, really. I don't know when it's going to be. I don't know if you want to have a wild guest for us, feel free. But sport doesn't need to look ahead now to the next stage, doesn't it? And it looks like that kind of thing's happening.
Yeah, December the 2nd at 4 p.m, John.
Very fantastic. I'll hold you to that.
There you go.
Imagine if you nailed it.
What can I say?
You'd retire.
Well, I retired years ago. Siobhan, don't you? No, it shows you the wheels are in motion. We just don't know. It kind of feels like the cycle's repeating itself when we first went into this. When will football be back? Can we play it? Is it going to be null and void? Are we going to get a neutral venue? It's fascinating. I'm curious as to how they're going to do it, though, whether they're going to be like a staged reintroduction of it, or whether they're going to wait until everything's completely clear. I mean, will everything ever be completely clear and let people in? Because the other side of it, I mean, it's hard enough getting a ticket now anyway, but who decides who gets to go in? Do you know what? These are the questions that are going to come up. So I don't know. If you ask me to nail it, I can't see anyone setting foot inside a football stadium this year. I'll be honest with you. Maybe not even till the end of next year. Might even see a whole season behind closed doors, which, well, then...
No way.
Well, I know, but then you're in that weird situation when you finally do get back and you're like, fucking hell, this is a bit weird, isn't it? But, no, I can't see it this year, John, to be honest. But apart from that, December the 4th at 4 p.m.
There we are. I mean, this phase return thing Andy's mentioned there, Ian, and I mean, who do you decide, you know, who is allowed on the ground? I mean, you're obviously hoping it's the side on who can bench the most, but you know, for the
a few out, John.
Well, Siobhan, I don't need, my arms are strong after, you know. I tell you, I'm carrying babies all over the shop. No, I mean, it is a tough one, isn't it? Jokes aside, you know, it's fair enough saying, okay, well, we could go to 10,000, 15,000, but we've got nearly 30,000 season ticket holders, and, you know, it's hard to imagine, isn't it, how you could do that in any way that it sort of, you know, please anyone, apart from the people who are in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we did, I don't think it's out yet, we did a changes show this week, and Rob Gutman was on it. You know what Rob, he's like, he's full of hopes and dreams, isn't he? And he was suggesting that maybe September, he felt fans could get in, which feels early to me. I was on board with it, like, I'm not going to lie, you know.
And that was just for his lounge, you know.
I'm banging into it, but I kind of, if I'm nailing my colours to the mast, I would probably, you know, err on the side of caution and maybe go along with what Andy just said there with it. Maybe this year feels too soon. I think there'll be a desire and an eagerness to get fans in for obvious reasons. And I think you've heard loads of integrity shouts just on restarting this campaign. And you think if you get next year's campaign or next season's campaign started and there's no fans in again for the first part of the season, but then they get reintroduced, you can imagine clubs saying, well, actually, I had to go to Anfield and there was fans there, but other teams went there early in the season and there was no one there, and it was a much different environment for obvious reasons and a much easier place to play football. So I think for those reasons alone, they'll be really, really keen to get supporters back in the ground. But obviously, as we always say in all these shows, the health factor will be the most important factor, and that's why I think, you know, they'll take the time with it. They won't be rushing it. You know, maybe they do start to say, you know, at some point, you know, if you do go to the match, it's at your own kind of risk, and maybe there's messaging around, you know, people of a certain age or people with vulnerabilities will take longer to maybe go back to football because there's more chance of them, you know, maybe pick up the virus, etc. So I think there's loads of things at play. It doesn't feel like it's any time soon, which is a real shame. But yeah, you can see a scenario maybe around December, January, when that is right back on the agenda and they're starting to think about getting football fans back into stadiums.
You know, they could do for a phase return, John. They could go retro with it. Do you remember back in the day for away tickets, they'd print a serial number in the Echo?
Odds and evens.
Yeah.
Do that in the Echo. But keep it off the internet, just in the printed Echo. You've got to go out and buy a printed Echo. If your season ends in six, you can get in this week. You're all right.
You know, saying about the Echo, I've been thinking about one way of doing this, which would rule me out. And I'd be gutted about this because I'm stuck living in London these days. But I wouldn't blame them if they said, actually, local supporters should be the first ones back in. Because if one of the things you want to do is stop people travelling.
But what if you need to test your eyesight, Cathy?
Well, there you go. Well, I would need to test mine, obviously. And I can only do that by being in a certain proximity of Anfield. Because actually, my optician is still in Liverpool. So you're right, I have the perfect excuse to get back and say match. Yeah. But I did wonder about that. You know, I was thinking maybe they'd be saying, actually, which, you know, would be good in a way, like to actually prioritise people who've got an address still living in the city. But yeah, that wouldn't help me at the moment. I'd have to move back a bit anyway. I mean, the thing that'd get me back, you know.
Do you wonder if the house prices?
Yeah, but I know they are really, it's true, yeah. I know they are desperate to get fans back in, and I think they'll probably be looking. I mean, most sports are looking at this thing of doing, like, you know, using every third seat or having in little bubbles, supposed bubbles or whatever. But it's been interesting reading the industry stuff on it, because people are getting really excited about, oh, we can use apps to get your food to your seat. Like, we really don't. That's really not an issue. You know, who cares about all of that? But also saying, oh, wouldn't it be great because, you know, no one could spill the beer on you, or you wouldn't, like, get hugged by that, like, drunk bloke behind you. And I'm like, what's the point in going to the match if I'm not going to get hugged by usually the drunk bloke in front of me? Like, to be honest, if we score a goal and I can't hug Bob, I don't quite know what I'm going to do, you know?
Like, I only go to the match to hug men I don't know, to be honest. Yeah, you. Like, yeah, I'm not sure what I'm getting out of it.
And I do think it'll be stranger for us the most, because, you know, you go to a lot of other grounds, and if you go, like, as a neutral, if there's such a thing, or a home fan or whatever, people don't all celebrate together like we do, you know? Yeah. A lot of places people celebrate quite individually, whereas, you know, it's just like a free-for-all in the cup, isn't it? It's just like one big pile on when we score.
Yeah, every third seat then might sort of go out the window.
Yeah, it'd be hard.
I do like a last-minute goal, though, when quite a lot of people on my row have sort of left early, and because it always means I can do a bit of a run. I've got a bit of space in there. I've got a track. I'm back and forth. You know, I've got space to express myself. Kind of, what can you say? There's a Deloitte report out today, in which I'm sure will be sharpening minds of CEOs of football clubs up and down the country, which is reflective of how much money football teams are likely to lose as part of this. The headline figure is £1 billion, but I think they've said that it's half of that they'll be lost forever. The other half, do you think they'll sort of get back eventually through sort of rearranged matches or sort of, you know, whatever it is. But that £500,000, and you fancy that Liverpool, you know, will be probably hurt by that more than others. Our gate receipts are higher, and we get, you know, greater percentages of TV revenue and stuff like that. So when you read that, you'll be able to, you know, you understand why, you know, these conversations are taking place, especially when you read things like the TV companies are saying, well, we don't want to pay as much because we're not getting the same product. The supporters aren't in there. Hey, and it turns out we're important after all.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, 100%. I think I think it is a really difficult conversation sometimes to maybe to appreciate, because I think, you know, as fans, we get wrapped up in the, well, who are we signing, you know, and there's been lots of talk around the team awareness stuff. And I, like yourself, John, I'm always up for challenging the owners and challenging the spend. I think it's important to have sensible discussions around stuff like that. But then when you do hear some of the figures being banging about, you can understand why a lot of clubs, certainly this summer, are going to take a very different view. I mean, I think it was Tottenham who have gone and borrowed about 175 million from the Bank of England to keep them ticking over. We're talking huge football clubs here that are having to look to loans just to get through the next, you know, few months, the next 12 months, whatever it may be. And then when you start to think about, you know, some of those other clubs further down the pyramid, you do start to fear for them. You start to wonder, actually, are they going to be in existence? You know, when can they start playing football again? I think, you know, I would have liked to have seen a scenario where some of the bigger clubs were feeding money down the pyramid, if you like, to allow some of those clubs to maybe do tests and stuff like that. But then you start to think, well, actually, are even the Premier League clubs able to do some of that? I mean, you'd like to think so, but then when you hear some of the news stories coming out, you do start to wonder just how well-run some of these clubs are. You know, we've obviously tend to touch on Everton quite a bit on some of these shows, and they've obviously made the decision this week to take the deferrals and stuff. And it was mad because some of their fans wanted the season to end. And I think what we've learned in the last few days is that's a club there that absolutely needs every penny at the minute. And just to stop playing football would have been quite disastrous for them and lots of others. So really turbulent times, I think, for lots and lots of clubs. I think it will separate quite a few, and I think you'll see a very mixed bag in terms of what clubs can do over the kind of coming months and years, certainly in terms of transfers and stuff like that.
Really, I don't know whether you've seen them, but some really interesting comments from Javier Tebas, who's the head of La Liga. He basically runs the Spanish league, and he's saying they're expecting summer transfer market spending across Europe will drop from $3 billion to just $800 million. And he goes on to explain that it's more of a problem for smaller clubs who haven't got other revenue streams. So it kind of backs up exactly what's been said about the Premier League. So hopefully maybe we can finally relegate Everton, unless Bill decides to spend the kazoo money.
We shall see. I mean, there's been a lot of opportunism throughout all this, Siobhan, but I think easily my favourite was yesterday, the Atletico Madrid chairman saying, uh-huh, if the Champions League's finished, we've basically won it, haven't we, because we beat the holders. I mean, unreal logic.
When I was a kid, people used to, like, I wasn't that engaged with it when I was really little, but people used to like say, oh, well, we beat you, so we should swap places in the table. It's that kind of logic. It's a 5-year-old on the playground's logic, but I'm all for it. It's very balls out there. I'm all, you know, good on him because he's really took his chance there, hasn't he? But yeah, it's just what Ian's just said, you know, like, and bringing in what you've just said, the opportunism, like it's sad that some clubs are going to probably do quite well out of how bad things are going to be for other clubs, you know, like kind of swooping in where other clubs just won't get the opportunity to. And I think the Timo Werner stuff has really put in fans' minds, particularly because I don't think it's ever really, I think people just assume that these billionaire owners will just lash money at it, and that's all that matters, is how important the things like gate receipts are and, you know, TV money is, and that something like this stopping it for just a few months makes such a catastrophic difference. And I think maybe if it does anything, it might make people think a little bit differently about how these things don't just happen like that.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting time for football governance, Cathy, and that's not a phrase I've necessarily used a lot in my life. In that, you know, there's talk about relaxations of FFP and things like that, because how can possibly football clubs balance the books in these certain situations? But even that is potentially a situation where some clubs might be able to take advantage of it. Oh, relaxation of FFP, you say. Certainly if I was a government looking to take over Newcastle United, you know, that'd be sort of music to my ears.
Yeah, I think it's tricky, you know, and there's always problems with all of this stuff, whether you have it's director's tests or FFP or whatever. But I think the whole structure really has to be looked at. And I don't necessarily think that weakening an FFP is the answer. I think maybe a restructuring and a relook at the way that FFP is working. But, you know, whenever you look at these things, you've always got to look at how are people going to circumvent it. It's like things like having a maximum wage and stuff like that, and having, you know, salary caps. The worry about salary caps has always been, well, it just goes under the radar. You know, they just find different ways. I mean, clubs have done this historically over the years, haven't they? You know, clubs buying cars, buying houses for parents. I mean, all sorts of stuff goes on. So I think I think it's really difficult to get a framework that is, you know, you're never going to get something that's completely foolproof or like, you know, that survives sort of, you know, governments wanting to do this sort of thing and take over football clubs who will take any sort of opportunity, you know, and will look at any loophole. Because one of the first things you can tell some of the owners are doing it. The first thing they're doing is looking for the loopholes. They're looking for how can we work this system, you know, how can we use it to our advantage. And, you know, it's often the smaller clubs and the ones who are just a bit more honest about the way they're doing things that are going to suffer. But yeah. I'm glad that the EFL and that Rick Parry is really looking at the whole structure of this. And, you know, parachute payments, all the rest of it, don't necessarily... I thought it was strong when he said, you know, the parachute payments were evil. I know what he means because it skews things. But again, if clubs just go off a cliff when they get relegated from the Premier League, that's not helpful either.
Okay. On a sort of positive note, Andy, the game is going to be taking place at Goodison Park next week, first game back, which feels like the right decision. Obviously, the Liverpool games will be at Anfield now as well. And it feels like important people have won important arguments on this, including, and it must be said, Merseyside Police. And Merseyside Police need praise. And I think throughout this, you know, because although police organisations, you know, or certain people in certain police organisations have you know, had their say, Merseyside Police seemingly throughout have seemed fairly relaxed about it and said, you know, any situations we'll be able to police, we'll be able to manage. There are people, let us look after them. And that's seemingly helped.
Yeah, they got on the front foot fairly early as well, which I think helped massively. Because it wasn't attributed to anyone that it might be at neutral venues. And then it's only really when Merseyside Police came out and went, well, look, it's not us. We haven't really particularly got a problem with it. And then it was kind of pinned down to Mark Roberts. But I think as well, because it has been resolved, there's a responsibility aspect of it, I think, as well, for us as fans and Everton fans to kind of respect that, because look, we all know, and Gareth Roberts has been absolutely brilliant on this. If you've read or listened to him over the last week or so, you know, on like, if we make a mess of this, it's not going to reflect well on us. But yeah, it was a refreshing change for Merseyside Police to come out and say, no, we haven't really particularly got a problem with it. Really excited. My only real question about Goodison is whether they're going to play the Bellew Bull on before kickoff now, before we tonk them 5-0. But no, great, can't wait.
So just before we take a break, has anyone got the match routine sorted yet? You know, presumably Wednesday nights will just be in front of the telly, hoping for the best from Arsenal. But you know, Derby night, has anyone managed to sort of, you know, position the TV by a patio wood window so they can have six people in the garden? You know, any chat what people are doing?
I'm dead annoyed.
Always, Siobhan, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's default lately. Well, no, lately, I'm 31. For 31 years, it's been default. But bedtime, all these evening games do not go well with having a child. Bedtime every single night, I'm going to have to swear bedtime and put him to bed at like 10.
I don't watch Liverpool in the league.
Yeah, well, you blamed him for long enough for Liverpool losing a couple of games, so it's about time something positive came of him. My old boss has actually set up a bar in his back garden and turned his telly round, so it's out the kind of porch window, so he's got his setup nailed down. I, apart from just disrupting every other routine in my life, I'm to watch it, like, no routine in our place apart from just being fuming.
I'm going to be sticking to my same routines, I think, but like, you know, weird stuff like the time that I take my season tickets out of the drawer and things, you know, daft stuff like that, but it's like that matters.
Yeah.
You know, not that I'm ridiculously superstitious, but you know, I'm not going to take any risks, am I, you know? Yeah. So all of those things, and the Jurgen Klopp snow globe is going to be in the right position behind the telly, and it's not going to be touched until then, because it can't be touched in between matches until we celebrate actually winning a game.
Where does one purchase a Jurgen Klopp snow globe?
One has to have amazing friends like mine who just randomly buy them a Jurgen Klopp snow globe. The best bit about getting the Jurgen Klopp snow globe actually was when it was a Christmas present, and it was wrapped up like in a box and everything, and he handed it to me, and I said, is this a Jimmy Traore snow globe in here? And he looked at me like, how the hell did you even know? Yeah. And then I opened up and it was like, well, it was Jurgen Klopp, not Traore, but yeah, randomly. Oh, I don't know where you get them from.
I mean, I don't know about everyone else, but
it served us well.
I'm going to sleep well knowing that the Jurgen Klopp snow globe is has been thought
it's,
of. Here
it's in its right this. Place. And it's, obviously, you know, talking of opportunism, the main thing I've been pleased about is that we will be the longest reigning, you know, champions of Europe probably ever.
I mean, superstitions are an important factor here, and it's something I'm not taught about, but is everyone making sure that the lucky socks are washed? Do you know what I mean? And everything's in place?
Lucky Lumbies, lad. I need to work out my support bubble game and see what I can do around that. I mean, I saw some people last night on Twitter, Banksy and Craig Cannon. I reckon you might have been one of them. So we'll see how that goes.
Certainly wasn't me. I'm having to clean our toilet every time he goes. I missed the whole match.
Oh, mate. Talking of superstitions, I'm going to strictly adhere to me 8 pints before kickoff. That's served me well. But no, seriously, if the league is at stake, I've got a cigar that I've kept from my wedding been waiting there, and I've got a nice bottle of red waiting there, but it's only for when the league's gone. So if the league's up for it, I'm gonna, and I've not smoked, as you know, John, I packed in smoking. So me head might fall completely off and fall into some cigar-induced coma at some point.
There we go. Do let us know what you've got planned, if you've got anything good. Drop us a message on Twitter and let us know if you've got any sorts of creative ways, or if you're just keeping everything exactly the same like Cathy is. We're going to take a little bit of a break now. Well, we are in sort of on this call. We've got an interview that Neil has done with Maggie from the West FC, who's done earlier in the week, that we're going to play now. And then we're going to come back into the Zoom chat, and we're going to talk about the last two players that we've got to discuss within the squad. We've been doing it week by week, and I hope you've enjoyed it. And we're on the final two. It's Minamino and Origi, so we're going to discuss them and their futures with the room. But yeah, in the meantime, enjoy this. As I said, it's Neil with Maggie from Lewis FC.
Neil Atkinson, joined here by Maggie Murphy from Lewis FC. I've finally had full clarification on the pronunciation of Lewis FC and my six other attempts at what a five-letter word. We've gone with Lewis, as it is correct. She's also from Equal Playing Field, the Equal Playing Field Initiative, equalplayingfield.com, to have a little look at that. And we're going to talk about a lot of the issues surrounding the women's game in general here. But the first one, ever so slightly from a Liverpool point of view, but a general point of view, Maggie, is it, in every part of every industry, what the COVID-19 pandemic has done is complicate things. And complicating things is absolutely fine. There often haven't been straightforward decisions. I know just from sort of running the Anfield Wrap, there haven't been straightforward decisions at times. So what was your sort of view of the decision to end the women's season early? You know, what did you think of it in its totality?
Yeah, massive question. Thanks, Neil.
easy one to start.
Maybe we need to break it down a little bit. No, I think in the end, when the decision was made, I barely raised an eyebrow to terminate early. And that's because I think it was on the cards for quite a long time. I think that it was made obvious very early on, and then despite kind of repeated requests otherwise, it was made very clear early on that there wouldn't be additional finance made available for clubs. And so without having the additional support and the additional finance, and without trying to find ways to help clubs make additional finance, it became a no-brainer in a way. We didn't have the extra several hundred thousand pounds that were needed to finish it. excuse me. And so eventually it just kind of was taken out of our hands in a little way. We couldn't continue. It wasn't possible. In the end, like personally, I didn't really have an opinion on whether it should be ended. In many ways, I mean, from Lewis's point of view, we were willing to continue if the funds could be made available or if we could be helped to find the funds. And so we could have taken a pause and then picked it up later in a few months if we wanted to. But then we were also in a position of, I don't know, privilege, would you say? We weren't going to be relegated. We weren't going to be promoted from our point of view. You know, the sporting integrity was kind of shot at that point because you know, it's just, if you're not playing for something, they were essentially going to be friendly games for us. So that's not fair for the people that are playing against us that have something to win or lose. So a lot of it's wrapped up. But ultimately, in the actual termination, it was kind of like we were being steered into a position where there wasn't really an option for us to do anything other than have it called.
In general, the key thing in the conversation around women's football is the idea of money, is the idea of capital. Within all of this repeatedly is where it sort of comes back to. You mentioned there the sort of the startup funds. It's, I think in general, what I think would surprise people, because I'm really pleased you're speaking to us. And one of the reasons why is whenever I try to talk about women's football, read things about women's football, it seems at times as though it's unbelievably opaque in terms of amounts, in terms of figures, in terms of detail, that there's very little that seems to be as though it's on the record. And I don't want to actually pin you down to being on the record, but the amounts of money you're mentioning there in a certainly in a Premier League sense, they are quite small sums of money. They're all quite small figures, and that is, you know, and that's, you know, you mentioned there that there'd be an inability to restart the season off the back of amounts of money that in the top two flights of men's football are really quite comparatively small sums.
Well, totally. I think it's not too, well, I mean, you know, the overall budget of a club in the WSL ranges between approximately 2 million to approximately 3.5 million, with maybe one, maybe two clubs going above that. But you're talking about a couple of million. That's not much. It's less for the clubs in the Championship. We're part-time, we're semi-professional. So then when you look at the, let's say it's like a couple of hundred thousand that was needed for testing to the same extent that they're doing in the Premier League. That kind of couple of hundred grand is very significant for a a Championship club, because, you know, our budgets are lower than what I've just mentioned. But, you know, for a big club, especially one that has a big Premiership partner to it, you know, these sums are tiny. But you said at the beginning, you mentioned, you know, that when you talk about women's football, it's preoccupied with finance. I'm going to throw that back and challenge you and say, actually, I think men's football is preoccupied with finance. Yeah. And as a result, women's football becomes preoccupied by other people's preoccupations about men's finance, like the finance of men's football. And we kind of forget about other elements of why we all love the game. And without going on about it, you know, the reason we all like football isn't because of the number of zeros on a balance sheet. We love football because of the stories, the passion, the player, the feeling of belonging, the teamwork, the identity, all those other cultural things. We kind of don't talk about that when it comes to women's football, because we kind of start throwing in financial figures and looking at it from that perspective.
So the argument becomes that what we end up doing, because we constantly are looking to find ways to have a conversation around women's football having to sort of justify itself one way or another, is that we ignore your contention, is we ignore the idea that the sheer justification is the playing of the game, which is something that we accept at almost all other levels of football.
Yeah. And I say that about football in general. Like, I think that, you know, and maybe this is the challenge to Premier League football as a whole, you know, lots of people are becoming disenfranchised with Premier League football. That's why we certainly see fans here at Lewis, whether at the women's games or at the men's games, are here because they've kind of lost a bit of faith with the Premiership football. But that's, I mean, I guess that's a slightly different thing. I think there is this, it's because when we raise issues around investment in sport, that's when I'll get the kind of people coming at me and telling me that I'm stupid. And that I don't understand, or that I don't get kind of commercial revenue, and maybe I should go back to school. You know, those are kinds of things that I get. And the way that I would level is maybe twofold. One is that, you know, the amount of investment that goes into the men's game is massive. And I'm talking not just from, you know, owners or from broadcaster sponsorship, but also from the taxpayer. Like, you know, I pay my taxes. My tax then gets divvied up and goes into schools and it goes into public parks. But when I look at the public parks, the kids that are using those public parks are boys and very few girls. And then in my school, you know, there weren't any opportunities for girls to play football. So even within like public spaces, let alone private club run spaces, we're already investing more in boys right at a super, super early age. So there's that kind of investment. Yeah, I was going to say something else, but it'll come back to me in a second.
But I mean, that's sort of where the start of the conversation around the game comes in. In terms of sort of speaking more and more about women's football across the last few weeks and in different ways, one of the difficulties, I think, is people seeing exactly what engagement means. And I think that that engagement happens to different sectors, to different people at different times. And they're trying to sort of program that engagement is something which I think is proven to be a little bit difficult. So in the FA plans, there's the idea that it's so hooked around the women's national side that everything is absolutely hooked into that in a way that I think is, if I say it verges on off-putting, I've got to be careful I'm not coming at this conversation with a Liverpool bias, but it makes it difficult to then translate that conversation as to what it means for a variety of different people, taking it from sort of 7-year-olds inspired to play right the way through to 70-year-olds inspired to become spectators. If the primary source is this sort of sole one thing that gets put above everything else.
Yeah, I think that's valid from my point of view as someone that runs a football club, a women's football club. I feel like obviously the visibility of the Lionesses on our TV screens is incredibly powerful and impactful, and I think that, you know, things like the World Cup being on TV and seeing the England team being there validates a space. It validates and legitimizes women's football as an acceptable thing that you might want your daughter or your sister to take part in, and you know that validation is really significant. I guess when it comes down to club level, you know, so you can accept the argument. I think that's powerful. I think the role models is really, really important. I wouldn't think that it has to stop at the England team. Like, I feel like we could do with a lot more visibility. If we buy that argument, we can also buy the argument that maybe more players, female players, more female sports stars on our TV screens would be a good thing and would be inspiring and would legitimize the space and et cetera, et cetera. And I do think that, you know, the FA has it very, very clear in their set of objectives. They have the ambition that England will win the next World Cup. That's explicit. The challenge can be sometimes for me, you know, running a club in the Championship, is that a lot of the energy is devoted to that goal. Mm. And it's about generating players that can play in that team. And for me, I'm kind of like, I'd love some of my players to make it. But actually, I want really good quality. I want a really good quality league. I want brilliant opponents. I want my team to be playing attractive football, and I want people to come down here and watch and take part and see local role models. So it does feel like we can be a little bit, we can almost kind of like fall victim to this heroicism thing around the Lionesses. But actually, like, you've got local heroes on your doorstep. Go and watch them.
No, just on that, I mean, there's a couple of things there which immediately strike out. One is that for me, I think it's a really strange thing and elite organisations need to do it, don't get me wrong, but to say that basically the plan is to win, well, what if you get a bad referee? What if you have an off day? And that therefore that we've fallen short of the plan. But if the plan is to have, for instance, or the plan is to have 22 footballers who are capable of being part of a squad that wins a World Cup, well, it's a good plan, don't get me wrong, it's a good ideal to have. But the flip side is, isn't it better to have 144 footballers who are all of a certain level, who can play every single week, who can represent the game? And I think that's where what I always feel clangs to have the wider conversation before we drill back down to the whole WSL thing. But that's what's always sort of clanged to me, is that the one time it feels as though it's just a participatory enterprise, apart from this one bit here, which is meant to be the super elite bit. But the other bit, it's framed as participatory rather than being, no, this is meant to be an elite league of an elite sport that's played by women in this country, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I do think it's challenging. I mean, the resources that have gone into supporting women's football have been so tight that, and there are so many gaps. There's so many gaps at grassroots. There's so many gaps I've mentioned in schools. There's so many gaps throughout this pathway through non-professional to semi-professional to then to professional and then to English. There's so many gaps that when some money comes in, you almost want to, like, I don't know, throw it, okay, well, we'll do the England team and we'll do grassroots. Oh, hang on a sec, grassroots, that's massive. Let's do schools. Oh, hang on a sec, there's loads of schools. But what can we, it's kind of like throwing, it's a piece of money. So Barclays have, you know, fantastically come on board as like big sponsor this season. But even that amount of money isn't enough to solve however many problems there are out there. And I think that sometimes it's difficult to figure out how to But it's basically, you're hoping for trickle down. You're hoping that by investing in the England team, it will trickle down kind of naturally and automatically. And I think it will to an extent, especially in terms of that validation and legitimacy. But, you know, there's still so many things we need to sort out, like pitches for all these pitches and coaches and clubs for all these new fans that do want to get engaged.
On coaching, I think to set that scene a little bit, it does seem to me to be one of the tougher, in general anyway. You can make a wider argument that there's a crisis of coaching in English football, full stop. Numbers of qualified coaches, how those coaches become qualified, the cost around that, what that process is, and then what they go and do. So this isn't necessarily a gendered discussion, but then when that then becomes, where there's pressure on that, when there's pressure on coaching, that's where decisions are made that seem at times obviously as though they skew towards where the long-term infrastructure is, where the long-term money has been, and that obviously pushes them more towards the men's game than the women's. It doesn't look to me as though, you know, without there being a really sort of root and branch approach around how the FA is going about every aspect of coaching. And again, this is where I feel it's really frustrating from a women's game point of view, because the FA's got a number of issues which cross into this, but which aren't specific to the women's game as well, but which then create specific problems for the women's game. If you see what I mean, my point is that it's another thing where we're able to say, well, it's really, really complex, but just saying it's really, really complex doesn't actually help us get to solve it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I know that there has been a lot of efforts that have been put into trying to support female coaches, for example, on the pathway. I think that's really, really powerful and important. I mean, we could talk about referees as well, right? So referees, that I think the FA brought out a press release last week about the huge jump in referees that they've, female referees that they've supported through the game. All of that is really important. And certainly there are some elements around communication, especially in coaching. I think that sometimes it's really important to have female coaches around that can kind of interpret language in an experienced way, let me say. But it does come back down to it being complex. And I think that, you know, investments are being made. We just need to keep on seeing those be sustained, I guess. Meanwhile, thinking about the cultural issues as well, like how do we break down barriers so that, you know, women can referee in the men's game and, you know, there can be female coaches in the men's game, because that's so rare to see. I think there is a cultural block which is really difficult for the FA to take on. I think it's an area where clubs and fans can do a lot better on themselves.
In terms of that, you know, there's what's happened with Liverpool this week, and I'm in the women's game. I'm always, again, I've mentioned the opaque thing before, but I think in general, there's a lot of goodwill. There's a lot of goodwill sort of collectively between the teams. You just said before, you know, you don't want Lewis to be the best team in the division by a million miles. You want it to be good games. You want the level to be as high as it possibly can be for everybody when they're playing against one another and testing one another. And I think that's an important point. But for me, sort of from the outside, looking in as a interested but still probably too casual for my liking observer of Liverpool women across the last few years, it does seem as though there's been a bit of a problem there in the opaque world, where there's been an awareness that Liverpool's either planning, commitment or infrastructure hasn't been what it needs to be. It's resulted in this relegation. They'll be dropping down into the division that your side plays in next season. How much does effectively the WSL, the women's game, the women's club game need a strong Liverpool, not just Liverpool, a strong Manchester United, a strong Chelsea, a strong Arsenal? How important is it that these sides, if you want to talk about the validation of the spaces, the representation, how important is it that these leading club sides are seen to firstly commit wholeheartedly to the women's game and then secondly produce good footballers playing good football?
Yeah, well, I think it's... I think it's really important. I mean, certainly my opinions about other clubs, so I'm a Spurs fan. My relationship with Tottenham Hotspur, but also my relationship and how I view other clubs has changed over the years depending on how they treat their women's clubs. So I think that there is a like reputational element in that, and I also think there's a forward thinkingness about clubs that are investing in women's football. It is, to be honest, the one area of growth in football right now. Why would you not be investing in that? Are you nuts? What do you think we're going to be doing in like 20 years? Do you really think women's football is going to be as small, let's say, as it is right now? No way. So what are you doing? What, do you not want to be top of the pack in all this? So hats off to the couple of clubs that really are trying and wanting to be on top of the pack. I just wish there were more clubs that were pushing them to go even further. At the same time, one thing I feel really strongly about is that women's football doesn't have to be the same as men's football. It doesn't have to follow the same paths. It should be able to do things differently. And quite a lot of the time, there are rules, you know, FA rules that are imposed on us that were made for the men's game that are not appropriate to the women's game. Most of the time, it's okay. We just work around them, or they don't impact us, or we're like, okay, that's a weird rule. Fine, we'll deal with it. But sometimes it can feel like we are being urged to... our activities, we're being urged, there's a favoritism, or there's, I can't say favoritism, maybe it's a bit too strong, but there is an assumption that for us to be successful, we need to be attached to a rich men's club. And I've, obviously, from Lewis FC, that drives me crazy, because we're doing our own way. Yes, we're punching above our weight in many people's eyes, because you haven't heard of us. Many of your listeners will not have heard of us, right? Mm-hmm. But we are in the same league as Aston Villa, as Crystal Palace, as Leicester, as, you know, Blackburn Rovers, all these big names. But we're doing things, we're trying to do things differently. And I don't want the rules to be created so that there is this dependency that's formed on a rich men's club. Because that it kills me that there are clubs out there that do not care at all about their women's teams and yet are in the same division as us, right? It's almost like the other way around. I feel like, you know, we should be rewarded for being so dedicated to our women's side, because that's because we think that's fair.
Is there an argument, and this is getting completely off the point, and you know, is there an argument that commitment, that's commitment's the wrong word, that sort of mindset, that focus, that pairs almost, that the will be the men's club, there will be therefore the women's club that gets attached, that could actually be inhibitive? I mean, to use a really, you know, an extreme example, using Liverpool, does Liverpool actually need to have two women's teams? Is you know, this is a valid question up to a point, but when you've got the football clubs as institutions that people have loved over a period of time, men and women, and that they want to see that representation, you know, again, it's another complex question, but it's a double-edged sword where, you know, is there an argument that that Liverpool may be better served to have one women's team that it gets behind, that it's able to work with, or are we, because of the long-term, decades-long dominance of men, centuries-long dominance of men's football, that we are, to an extent, stuck with the mindset that creates the idea that there will be a Liverpool men's team, a Liverpool women's team?
I mean, I think Liverpool should have 10 successful women's teams, first and foremost. But, no, I think it's really important for the big clubs to have women's teams, but it must, their commitment to women's football needs to go beyond, here's a budget line for you. That commitment has to run through and impact on the club's culture. It has to impact on the club's, the way that they make decisions, on governance, on leadership, on visibility, on profile. Like, any kind of budget line needs to be accompanied by, and you have a seat on the board. And by the way, you know, it's not just you. There's all these other people that are really, really supportive and want to hear your updates on how the women's team is going. So there is that commitment. There is that side of it. But here's the rub. I think if you don't have that, and sometimes what I feel I see from other clubs that are part of a bigger club structure, is they are not free to voice their opinions in consultations and discussions, because they might have an opinion, but it has to be validated, or it has to be given by the men's side of the club. And, you know, that's, I have a freedom. You talked about opacity in the women's game. There's opacity because a lot of the women's clubs are not free to speak openly, or their opinions can only go so far, and then they need to be checked or validated or signed off. Even if it's just being signed off, they have to be signed off by someone else. And that's why, you know, at Lewis, we're happy to talk about it, and we'll talk about finances and all the rest of it. But we do have a freedom, because I don't have to sign something off on the men's side of the club, other than club policy, which we sign off together.
Last little thing. I've taken up a lot of your time in your afternoon. There is there is the restart and the opportunity the restart presents. It is, you've elsewhere written extensively and intriguingly, I'd say, around the FA Cup as a strong example in terms of changing the way in which that's financed. You know, the FA Cup on the men's side has seen an increase of just shy of £20 million pounds worth of prize money across the last three seasons, £50,000 on the women's side approximately. It is effectively the prize money on the women's side is approximately 1% of the prize money on the men's side. That there's tons and tons of opportunities to equalise that, and that, you know, I've been speaking a variety of different ways that this restart should actually have given us pause about sort of how football decisions are made, but it isn't. It isn't beyond the wit of anyone really to see this pause and then followed by a restart as an opportunity to reset. Mm. Do you think? Are you worried this will be proved to be a missed opportunity around things like FA Cup prize money, around things like exposure for these club sides in a televisual sense? Is this something that concerns you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have a history as a club of campaigning on some of these issues, right? So we're well known for our gender equality stance, but we also do things like we campaign against the normalisation of gambling. So we reject any gambling company money. And in fact, we put a logo of a charity that supports families who have lost loved ones through gambling on our shirt fronts instead. When we were approached by a gambling company. So it was kind of, no, thank you. And by the way, we'll do this. So we have this history of doing it, but on the gender equality stuff, you know, this isn't theoretical or philosophical. The amount of money that we won for our FA Cup fourth round game was £2,000. And then we went on to get knocked out by Arsenal in the next round. And for that game, our fourth round, we won £2,000. But if we had been male for that exact same fixture, we would have won £180,000. Now, that would have helped us if all of the other women's teams had won that this year or last year, or, you know, the clubs that certainly had played there and won their fifth round would definitely be able to afford to finish the season because we'd be able to afford all the COVID protocols, right? So this is not theoretical. This is like hard fact. If there is no money here, then we cannot compete. And I think I just want to be clear on that because it's not equality for equality's sake. It's equality so that we can actually play the game. And then in terms of missed opportunity, yeah, like, I think this, you know, change comes when big things happen. A pandemic is perfect for change. It's perfect for us to, like, stop and take stock of what we like about football and also what we don't like. And maybe just figure out that maybe we need a bit of a reshuffle along lots of different fronts. And for us, I really think it comes back down to this focus on money. Like, we have this preoccupation with revenue and with the amount of money that is generated by men's football. And if you think about it, all the conversations about the restart have been around, you know, sponsorship money or broadcast money and will they pay it back or won't they pay it back and all the rest. It's all been about money. It's not really been about player safety. Players themselves have raised issues around player safety. All this is to say is that I feel like we need to go back to basics of what football means. And it means being part of a community that feels something, that is united, that sees these role models, that admires ambition and skill and teamwork and tactics and contributes to a community, but also draws from that community. It's not just about money. Money is like one of those elements. And I just feel like, you know, if we had a world where we were broadcasting WSL games and preferably championship games on TV right now, people would be watching. And we would, in the way that people became fans last year during the World Cup, they would watch those games and they would become fans. They would start to know the names of the players in a team that represents the other half of their club. And I just kind of feel like we've not been ambitious enough to try and get that through. And that in a couple of years, we'll be like, oh, that was the right moment, wasn't it? And we didn't do it. And we just kind of gave up too early. That's my fear, I guess.
Thank you very much to Maggie. Hopefully she'll be open to speaking to us again in the next few weeks and months. We'll see if we can take up more of her time then. But I'll hand you back over.
Okay, thanks a lot to Neil for that. We are back in the room. I'm still joined by Siobhan, by Cathy, by Ian, and by Andy. And we're going to talk about Minamino and Origi. But before that, a couple of little bits of housekeeping. First of all, Andy Heaton's just had a message saying that at some point, the highlights from the game we talked about earlier, this Blackburn one, will be on LFC TV. So it'll either be tonight or tomorrow morning, I guess, depending on when they can get them all ready. But yeah, so that'll be good. So we will be able to watch the Reds in action against Blackburn, wherever that is and whatever that is. We'll be able to see a little bit of it, which is great. Also as well, we were talking about the return of football. And just to let you know that the Anfield app will be doing commentary on, well, as many games as possible, really, or as many games as we can throughout this period. So obviously, you know, we will be watching in small groups, as we mentioned, or on our own or with families or whatever. It'd be nice to try and create some of that, watching it with your friends. So that's what we're going to try and do. So hot mic commentary, you can sync it with your telly, and it allows you to get us at the Anfield Wrap instead of the whoever it is who's doing it on the TV. So that might be a nice little alternative for you. So we'll be doing the Wednesday night games. We'll be doing the return up to including hopefully Arsenal doing us a bit of a favour against Manchester City, and we'll be doing certainly all the Liverpool games between now and the end of the season. So if you fancy a bit of us instead of the traditional commentary, you'll be able to get that. If you just download the Hot Mic app, it's free. It's on Android and Apple. If you download the Hot Mic app, put the referral code in Anfield Wrap, and then also follow the Anfield Wrap on there. You'll just get notifications whenever we go live. So we'll try and keep people up to date on our social, obviously, with what we're doing. But if you do download the app and follow the Anfield Wrap on there, you'll get notifications wherever we go live. And yeah, watch the game with us, and you might find it a little bit more fun and more like your normal matching experience, especially if you sit on my row. You know, normally you'll get all my pearls of wisdom of man on and 10, which is mainly what I shout at Liverpool players. Okay, anyway, so part three is we're going to talk about Minamino and Origi, and we'll start with Minamino, and I'll start with you, Siobhan. He's sort of become a bit forgotten man, hasn't he, Minamino? Mm. You know, when there's all this talk about Werner and signings and things like that, a few people did have to point out, including to me, well, we did sign this fella in January, and he did look really good before he's come, and it's also easy to forget how little opportunity he's sort of had, really, to make an impact, because... You know, you think, well, he's had half a season. Well, he hasn't really. He's basically had 2 months.
Yeah, he has. And I think the circumstances in which he came in were a bit, maybe, like, the expectations were probably really high. Was it not the Everton FA Cup game was his first?
Yeah, it was his first.
And I think that there was a lot of shouts of him, you know, being kind of the doing a Van Dijk and coming in and scoring on your debut against Everton. Maybe some wildly unfairly disappointed people when he didn't. And yeah, he hasn't had much of a chance, has he? And there was a lot of talk of him not quite getting to grips with the change of pace of the Premier League, and particularly in a, you know, in a kind of attacking sense. And I'd like to think that this time off, for want of a better term, has given him the space to get his fitness to the same level as everyone else's, to get his head in the same place as everyone else's, you know, just to be able to kind of build those relationships that people would probably expect him to build a little bit too quickly. It's hard to tell what he would have done in the time since, because you'd like to think that he would have wrapped up the league a really long time ago, and he would have just been able to do that without anything at stake. But I'm hopeful that this will have been a valuable few months for him, really.
Yeah, this period might help him. You don't really know sort of, you know, how anyone's really sort of cope with lockdown. But for him, you know, he has been in the same situation as all the other Liverpool squad. It's maybe given him a bit more time to kind of settle at home, settle in the area, do those few DIY things that he's been putting off, like all of us. And
also, his game.
And also, you know, he's been joining the Zoom chats like everyone else. You know, we've added the Japanese element to the happy birthdays, I've noticed, which is Gordon. And then he's had this sort of little mini pre-season. I saw him score a belter on the things they showed, a little flick with the back of the boot, which was almost Ian Ryan-esque. It could be a nice little period, and we could look back and think, you know what, that's, you know, and he might come out to say, you know, that's when I really sort of started to feel like a Liverpool player, because it's hard to join, you know, midway through a season, isn't it, especially when, you know, it's another language, the team's flying, and you're coming from another league.
Gibbo, I mean, it's hard to join in normal circumstances to join in the circumstances that he's joined, where, you know, he's come in January and then within a month or two, everyone's on lockdown and in a totally different environment for him. I mean, you can't even imagine how difficult that's been for him to adjust, I think. In terms of a player, I mean, I was made up when we signed him. It was one of them where, you know, small fee and stuff, so maybe people don't get hugely excited, you know, just over 7 million quid. But I think we'd all seen enough at Anfield in that 4-3 Salzburg game to suggest we were signing a very, very good footballer. I mean, that night he was absolutely instrumental. You know, they found themselves 3 down fairly early on. And then, you know, Hwang, Haaland and Minamino were just, you know, outstanding across the 90. And Minamino in particular, he gets their second goal. And in terms of opposition players coming to Anfield, in recent years, it's right up there. It really is right up there. I think age-wise, he's at a good age. He's 25. He was 1 in 2 for his country. He's probably around 1 in 3 for Salzburg when he was there. I think he did 5 years there. And I think the sporting director for Salzburg was talking in January and very much said, you know, he's at that stage in his career now where he's absolutely ready for a big move to a European club. He gets his Premier League debut against Wolves, but I think he comes on for Mane, and I think you could tell that night that it's going to maybe take him a little bit of time, but we knew that. You know, we've had footballers in this country move to Liverpool and it's taken them a little bit of time because, you know, they've got to get to used to working for this manager, and Jurgen Klopp expects a lot from his football players. So I think, you know, that should be no surprise to anyone. And it will take him a little bit of time, but he's training with these lads day in, day out, or he will be again shortly, or he is now. And that will help him loads and loads. So I think there's lots to come from Minamino. As I say, I was excited when we signed him. And I think if Liverpool do get the league wrapped up pretty sharpish, you should start to see him get more minutes as we move through the last 9 games.
Well, I mean, all that said, Cathy, would you like to have seen a little bit more from him, you know, since then? You know, he's sort of played primarily seemingly as a 9, which is a bit of a surprise. You know, it seemed like Klopp's giving him a go, you know, in the sort of Firmino role kind of more than the others that you maybe see. I don't know. I think, you know, I might be sort of playing a little bit devil's advocate here, but I think for all the talk of Yeri, he will need time to settle. I'm surprised we have not seen a bit more from him, considering the player that I saw, you know, play for Salzburg.
Yeah, and I think for us, because we'd seen him play at Anfield, we'd seen him play against us, so we sort of knew what he could do against a team like ours in that setting. So, yeah, I think expectations were quite high, really. We all thought, well, he's just going to slot straight in. This is going to be really easy. But I think it is hard to know because of the position that he's been played in. I don't think he's really had time to settle into playing in a position that he's comfortable in for a whole game, you know, very often. It's like it's been bits and pieces, it's felt like, here and there, rather than him really moving into where it's going to be a clear role for him. So I think it has been hard. And I did some work on this years ago, and I remember I met with people like Lucas to talk to them actually about what it was like when you first move countries, you know, when you first sign for clubs. And it sort of blew my mind how hard it is actually for players, because we tend to just think, you know, never mind all the rest of it. You don't need to worry about moving house or any of that stuff. You know, you're getting looked after. Just come and do what you need to do on the pitch. But actually, there's a hell of a lot of adjustment that they need to go through, just in terms of, like Siobhan said, working for that particular manager, you know, just getting used to their teammates, getting used to what's expected. And I get the sense that what's expected is quite different. But I think what's disappointed me so far is he doesn't look strong. He looks lightweight. And I just think he's going to need to be stronger. And we've seen that with other players. I mean, people said that about Firmino in that role. You know, it's easy to forget now. Firmino got a lot of criticism when he first signed.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And we've seen players like that, like Coutinho and others, that do always actually sort of seem too lightweight, but depending on the role that they've played, you sort of forgive them for it, you know, because they've got something else that they can contribute. It feels a little bit like he's sort of neither one nor the other.
My sort of only real concern with it, Andy, is that when these surprise teams break through and no one knows much about them, and then they burst on the scene, and then all the big clubs rob all the best players, which is how football works, unfortunately. Some of them tend to do well and some of them don't. So I've used a couple of examples sort of in the agenda, which is Monaco, Leicester and Alaves. So these teams do really well, and then everyone comes and sort of grabs the players. And it transpires that a few of them have managed to sort of elevate the others. So not all of them do well. So for every Mbappe, there's a Bakayoko. For every Kante, there's a Drinkwater, you know, who just sort of, you know, goes to these big clubs and it just transpires they were never great. So we already know that Haaland is in the former category because he's completely hit the ground running. Have you got any concern that Manamino might be another sort of Bakayoko and Drinkwater?
Well, there's no guarantees over anything. What I would say, though, is that you're on a hide and snot in any player in Europe coming in, unless you're Mbappe walking into this front three, because the bar is so high. I think you've got to bear that in mind. Like, we're talking about three of the best players, you know, the best front three in Europe. And, you know, it has been a little bit stunted, and maybe he's feeling a little bit more pressure that he's got to produce instantly when he's been on. But you saw enough, I know Ian said before, we saw enough when he's been playing against us that there is something there, and maybe this little break would do him a bit of good. I think Cathy's spot on. I think it's a recurring theme with Liverpool players, the amount of players we've seen who haven't really shone for the first 3 or 4 months. Oxlade-Chamberlain, Fabinho, Jorginho, and Alden. You know, just to get up to speed with the fitness and the strength. The other thing I'd say, touched on there, was brilliant, and I think I've told this story before about acclimatisation, you know. It isn't looked at enough, and I think Liverpool are much better at it now than what they were. I mean, there was a story about a player we signed a couple of years back, and it's very much a closed existence, almost like the locked away. So, and the other problem where his family was all in his own country, and he was literally stuck in Formby from 9 and like 20. Apart from when he was at Melwood, he was at home or at Melwood.
Yeah.
And even something as basic as he had to call someone out, the lad who was looking after him had to go out and buy a 4G dongle so he could Skype his family at home. It sounds ridiculous. And, you know, we talk about all this money and they're overprivileged and they should hit the ground running. But how can that not factor in? Do you know what I mean? Especially when you're... One thing I'd say as well is it's different when you've got packs of nationalities or packs of people who speak Brazilian or Portuguese or Spanish.
Yeah.
You know, whereas he's kind of... I'm not making presumptions. Maybe he speaks perfect English. I don't know. But that must also be a bit of a challenge. So I'm willing to ride it out. I'm confident. I mean, look, the amount of scepticism that you used to have for our transfer committee compared to the amount of faith I've got in it now, you know, I think we need a much larger sample.
Okay. Ian, Andy mentioned there about anyone is on a Highland and often trying to come into our front three. Someone who certainly suffers from that is Divock Origi, because when he has come in, not only has he not looked quite to the same level as the others, but then everyone else's performance drops as well because, you know, they're not getting the benefits of the other guy brings. You know, I mentioned, you know, Minamino, maybe the forgotten man before. There's no chance that Divock Origi will ever be forgotten because of what he's done at Liverpool. But if he's not the forgotten man, he might just be starting to look a bit like yesterday's man.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how kind of Origi's story plays out now, because I think you could easily have made a case for him maybe leaving the club at the end of this season. You know, that might change now, given, you know, some of the constraints around the finances, etc. You'd always feel a little bit harsh maybe having a pop at Origi because of what he's done, and there's no doubt he's given Liverpool fans some of the greatest nights and greatest moments of their lives. You know, some of the goals he's scored, you know, the big goals, you know, European Cup finals, semi-finals, it's, you know, the goals in the derby, and he's terrorised Everton. I mean, you love him in so many ways, but then, you know, there's fault there in terms of him as a footballer at times. He doesn't quite always hit those levels consistently. And I think, you know, even beginning of the season, he starts against Norwich and he scores that night. And I was quite pleased when I watched him that night because I thought he was making loads of intelligent runs from out to in, and I don't think he always does that. Origi, I don't always think he shows loads and loads of game intelligence. Don't get me wrong, at certain moments he could be fantastic, but you do always think there's a drop off there, and there's no doubt. I mean, you know, most footballers are a drop off from our front three, but when you're going for the very top honours and the best honours, maybe you do want a little bit more quality than what Origi can show at times. Don't get me wrong, Gibbo, I mean, there's times when that quality does shine through. You think about the derby goal against Everton. This the 5-2 game where Lovren hits that long pass and he just pulls it out the sky and tucks it away like it's the easiest thing in the entire world, and it was far from that. It's an unbelievable finish. The finish against Barcelona is ridiculous, the Trent one. He's got no right to be able to take that so easily when there's so much pressure on the game. It's just out of the blue, and yet he's able to kind of, you know, deliver such a kind of key moment. But you do always come back to certain games where you think it's bouncing off him a little bit. Or I mean, sometimes he just doesn't back himself. I think, you know, for the physical size of him, you wouldn't want him running at you. And I think sometimes maybe he could back himself a little bit more. But I think there's things around making maybe more intelligent runs at times. And it's not quite there consistently. No doubt goes down as a legend because of what he's done so far. But I think all things being equal, Liverpool maybe would have looked to have moved him on this summer.
Yeah, I think he possibly would have gone, you know, with this summer, Siobhan, and that sort of feels less likely now because of everything that's going on. And obviously, you know, there certainly will be a Timo Werner in his way. I think Origi's problem as well is that he was getting this reputation as sort of a great off the bench, but even that sort of seems to have gone away. I had a little bit of look at his goals so far this season. You know, Ian Ryan mentions that one against Everton. He got two that day, but he's only got five all season so far for Liverpool, and they've all come in starts. So he gets two in that Arsenal League Cup game, and then one very, very opening day of the season against Norwich. And apart from that, there's nothing, and there's no goals in 2020, although we can't blame him too much for April. But I think you know, when you're able to sort of throw someone on and they're showing you bits like that and stuff, you're like, well, at least we're getting that from him. You know, he might not be necessarily, you know, as good in the front three starting in front of the others, but at least he's a plan B. He sort of stopped being a plan B as well for Divock Origi, and that might be what sort of does for him as much as anything.
Yeah, it's hard to tell what the intention is for him because it seems it's only this time last year, not even, that he was signing a new long-term contract with the club. Yeah. And you wonder whether that was just done as a kind of a thank you for what he'd done in the last couple of months, or just to make sure that he had some value, you know, when he did eventually go, you know, who knows. And, you know, another player that is probably consigned to that, despite what he's done, and probably because of what he's done, not quite meeting expectations, because you think he's going to pop up and do the same thing all over again, and he's just not, you know, it can't be expected of him. So it's hard to tell. Obviously, we were just saying about, you know, Minamino maybe getting more of an opportunity now that Timo Werner's not going to happen. It's maybe more by necessity than design, but maybe Origi will now as well. So, yeah, he's one of those that you'd always be really sorry to see him go, but you're right. Like the expectations are, he's people are probably thinking bigger than him right now, aren't they, Sam?
Yeah. It's interesting, Cathy, as well, in that when he came in, well, when Jürgen Klopp came in, should I say, he was a big Origi fan, but not just that, he was a centre forward. You know, we were playing more 4-2-3-1 there, and it was Divock through the middle. He was his main fella. You know, he starts him away at Dortmund, which is arguably his first, you know, massive game, you know, Jürgen Klopp. And, you know, and then now, even when he is playing, it's actually very rarely down the middle. He seems to prefer him wide. I know it's, you know, I know the front three are very interchangeable, and, you know, it gives him an opportunity to cut in, but he's, you know, he's getting limited opportunities anyway, but seemingly very few, you know, in that number nine position.
Well, I think when Klopp came in, I can see why he liked him, because if you look at Origi on the face of it and you sort of see his highlights and you see the skill that he obviously does have, that, you know, he doesn't seem to use often enough, but we've seen, as you've said, like, you know, he's got scored some really skillful goals. We've seen some amazing play from him at times, but the problem with him is he doesn't use his physicality, he doesn't use his body properly, and I think that's what Klopp realised. You know, he was playing him down the middle, where, you know, you need somebody with a bit more of a physical presence. And what's weird about Origi for me is, for, you know, he's a big lad, but he doesn't really get his body into people. Like, you see, he plays like as though he's a lightweight player, and he's a big guy, and that really frustrates me with players that do have that physicality, that are strong, that are tall, that really should be able to use the body in a better way. He should be able to really fend people off. And too often for me, he's shoved off the ball by people off his size. You know, and I think that's a problem, really, because, like, he's one of those players, isn't he? Like, a lot of the other players, you know, they talk about, like, how intelligent he is, and he speaks all these different languages, but he's always a little bit sort of out of it, you know? Like, he's always the one who leaves his kit behind. He doesn't really know what he's doing. And I think he plays a bit like that. Like, he just sort of wanders onto the pitch sometimes, and you're thinking, are we going to get those fleeting moments where he's suddenly really energetic and bursts through into the box and scores a goal, or is he just going to be sort of faffing around and, you know, getting shoved off the ball too easily?
So if you were Divock Origi's agent, Andy, which, you know, I'm not ruling out in your future, to be honest with you, what would you be advising him at the moment or this summer?
I'd be advising him to sit tight. I mean, I mean, you read off the statistics there, and he hasn't been effective off the bench, but 10 times this season when he's come off the bench, it's been less than 15 minutes to go. So you don't know whether, we've more than likely been in a position when we're winning, so we're not really going to be as offensive as what we might be. I mean, I think it's a peculiar one with Liverpool, because if you're not playing, Jürgen's always gone on about rhythm, and I don't think he's had the chance to get particularly any real rhythm in there. And as you said yourself, when he's come on, he's not played in his natural position. So, I mean, I think it's a tough one. I wouldn't mind at all if he stuck around, and I think he's still got big goals in him when you need him, when he's played in his preferred position. And then the other side of it is, you look across the continent, you look at, you know, Real Madrid, Manchester City, Bayern Munich, Juventus, Barcelona. Can you name their four choice striker?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, you generally have your leader, so if you play two up top, who's your third? If you play three, who's your fourth? And I think if you look at him as a four choice striker, the goals he scored in big games, I think there's still value in there, especially relative to what we paid for him initially. So I'm fairly laid back about it, to be honest. I mean, if they sign someone,
because you're on a beach, Andy, you know what I mean.
Seaforth, lad, innit? Seaforth, bit blowy, like. But no, I think you'd struggle to find a four choice striker for a fairly insignificant amount of money that will score you the goals that he's scored for Liverpool.
Okay, I know that's a fair point. That is a fair point. Okay, before we go, I'm going to put you all on the spot and ask you, who's going to play more minutes between now and the end of the season, Minamino or Origi? So have a little think, and then we'll all get back on this call in 7 weeks' time, and loser has to do shots.
What's the wrong answer?
So we'll start with you, Ian. Minamino or Origi, who's... Who's going to get more minutes between now and the end of the season?
I think it'll be Origi, Gibbo, for the reasons I mentioned before. I think there's still a little bit of a learning curve for Minamino yet, so I'd say Divock will get more minutes.
Okay, Siobhan?
On the basis that I don't mind being wrong, I'm going to say Minamino, just because if the league's wrapped up nice and early, it might be a good time for him to get that rhythm that Ian said he hasn't got right now. So.
Okay, Cathy?
I'd say, Miss Siobhan, I think Minamino, it'll be a good sign, I think, if he does, because it should mean that we've wrapped the league up and he's wanting to see a bit more of him. He knows what he can get out of Origi. He doesn't know yet what he can get out of Minamino.
Okay, and Andy?
I think if they wrap it up early, it'll be Origi, because as much as I've just said, they keep him. If he gets a run of game and scores a couple of goals, you might entice an offer for him in the summer that might not have otherwise been forthcoming.
Okay, I'm going to go with Minamino, just because I'd rather get on the shots with Siobhan and Cathy than Ian and Andy. But you know,
it's been a long time coming, John.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
It has been a long time coming. Okay, let us know again who you think. But in the meantime, huge thanks to everyone for joining me on this call. Obviously for Neil for doing that insert with Lewis FC in the middle as well. And enjoy your weekend. Enjoy the highlights of this game against Blackburn whenever we get them. And yeah, plenty more across the weekend, obviously from the Anfield Wrap. But then we're back with the free show on Monday. And some hot mic action at the weekend as well. We're doing a German game at the weekend. I can't remember who. I think it's Bayern Munich. And then there'll be hot mic AFQ as well. So if you want to get involved in any of that over the weekend, download the app and get involved in the meantime. Nice one, and up the Reds.
Thank you for listening to the Anfield Wrap. Listen, you're probably going to get bored of this over the next few weeks. We're putting this at the end of every show. It's Neil Atkinson here, whether I hosted this show or not, to ask you to vote for us in the British Podcast Awards. To do that, you go to britishpodcastawards.com/vote, and there you'll find it is the Listener's Choice Award, supported by BBC Sounds. If you search for the Anfield Wrap in the box that comes up, you will get the Anfield Wrap, or TAW also gets us the Anfield Wrap as well. So TAW gets you the Anfield Wrap, or the Anfield Wrap in there. And then from there, if you vote for us, you'll then get an email that you'll have to click to confirm the vote. And then from there, you've registered the vote, and we appreciate it very much. We've never won this award in the British Podcast Award. We've come second 3 consecutive years. We discovered that last season we were a little bit closer than we thought last season, last year. Good Lord, not everything works like that, Neil. And so we thought, well, let's give it a real go. We'll give it a big push this time out. So hopefully you've been able to do that for us, and hopefully you're happy to do so as well. We do always appreciate the support in any way in which it comes at the Anfield Wrap, and especially through what's obviously been a difficult time for a number of podcasts for obvious reasons. Anyway, thank you very much indeed, and take care. Sports Social Podcast Network.